It's Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Republican lawmakers are suing Attorney General Josh Call. They say that he's not abiding by laws passed during last year's lame duck legislative session. We'll learn more about that lawsuit in a bit, along with other Capitol political news. First, when it's hot out, one delightful way to cool down is with an ice-cold treat like a popsicle. And this edition of Food Friday, we're going to explore ways to create those refreshing treats at home while using primarily natural and healthy ingredients. Sarah Bond is a recipe developer and the creator of the food blog Live, Eat, Learn. She's also the author of For the Love of the Popsicle, Naturally Delicious Icy Summer Sweet Summer Treats from A to Z. She joins us from the Netherlands. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
What inspired you to build essentially an encyclopedia of popsicles?
It actually started with smoothies. So I really love making smoothies. I think it's a really fun way to kind of play with flavors and ingredient combinations. And so I make those a lot just to have like a healthy breakfast. But living over here in Europe, we actually don't have air conditioning. So it can get really hot in the summers. And so I started freezing some of my smoothies into popsicles just as like survival. And they always seem to turn out really well. So I began putting some of those recipes on my food blog. But I just had so many ideas for popsicles that I decided to write the book. And so For the Love of Popsicles was born.
And does there seem to be a growing interest in popsicles, in frozen treats, not just here in the U.S., but around the world?
I've noticed it mostly when I go back to the States to visit. I see all the little artisanal popsicle shops popping up everywhere. And I don't think that those are really catching on here quite yet because they still have like the really nice gelatos and mm-hmm. sorbets here. So I think we're still away from popsicle shops here, but I'm leading the charge.
And what is it about homemade popsicles that can make them superior to store-bought ones?
Well, I just really like knowing what's going into the popsicles first and foremost, but then also I just find it's a really nice way to sort of use up all that fresh summer produce in a way that's, it feels nice. It feels fancy when you pull out homemade popsicles, everyone is excited. And it's just a really nice way to sort of celebrate summer.
And you have a degree in nutrition and dietetics. What kind of adventure was this for you when you started developing recipes and wanting to make them healthy so that they certainly were a treat, but that they weren't a huge cheat?
A lot of popsicle recipes that you'll see in cookbooks or that you'll see online tend to have a lot of sugar in the form of simple syrup. Can you hear me?
Yes. We lost you for a little bit, but you're back.
Yeah, so a lot of popsicle recipes that you'll see have a lot of sugar in the form of simple syrup. And this isn't only for flavor and taste, but it's also for the texture because the sugar is important in helping to prevent those ice crystals from forming. And so for a while, I sort of thought, oh, well, healthy popsicles isn't that attainable because you need to have the sugar to have that nice texture of the popsicles. But once I started experimenting and really playing around with the amounts of sugar and honey I was putting in, I realized that you really don't need that much sugar to make a really nice popsicle if you're using really ripe fruit or if you're using, honey or natural sweeteners. So it was sort of an adventure finding ways to make the popsicles still taste really nice and taste like a dessert or a treat while keeping them healthy. But I managed to get the sugar levels and a lot of those sweetener levels down in the popsicles just through trial and error and playing around with the different fruits we were using.
And you also played with what the creamy base was, because a lot of more traditional recipes might call for heavy cream or even sweetened condensed milk. And those are delicious, but not something that you would necessarily feel okay having even daily, let alone multiple times on a really hot day. What did you find works well for that base?
Yeah, exactly. So I use a lot of coconut milk, just canned coconut milk, and then plain Greek yogurt. So I like to use the full fat variety of these because it makes the texture nicer in the end, but it still is healthier than using heavy cream or sweetened condensed milk, like you said. And if you don't like coconut milk or Greek yogurt, or even like flavored yogurt, you can even use like pureed banana. That also has a really nice texture when you freeze it. It's kind of creamy and sweet, and it's without the dairy or.
We're talking with Sarah Bond right now. She is a recipe developer and the creator of the food blog Live, Eat, Learn. We are talking with her today because she is also the author of For the Love of the Popsicle, Naturally Delicious Icy Sweet Summer Treats from A to Z. And I have to say, looking through your book, which first of all is gorgeous, the photos really do, I think, do your popsicles justice. I was amazed at, you know, the range of flavors and flavor combinations that you have. Where did you even begin in trying to think of what things you might want to put together in a popsicle?
Yeah, well, like I said, like a lot of it came from previous trial and error with smoothie recipes. So I had already tried a billion different things with smoothies, like putting together basil in a smoothie or adding Nutella to like spinach smoothies just to see what would work. So I had a lot of experience with that. And so a lot of those were transformed into popsicles for the book. But then I also like, there's a book called The Flavor Bible, and there's also a Vegetarian Flavor Bible. And it's really nice because you can go through and you can say, okay, I want to make something with pineapple. You like scientifically based on flavor profiles, which ingredients go with that fruit or vegetable. So that was really nice for finding sort of out of the box or unique ideas for what to pair with different fruits and vegetables. And so I use that a lot in developing the recipes and sort of coming up with new twists on what the classics people might want in a popsicle.
And what were some of the combinations that you maybe were pleasantly surprised at, how well they work together? I remember you saying that you were surprised by how well basil works with fruits.
Yeah, basil works really well with blackberries or strawberries and pineapple. So I have a basil pineapple one in the book and then also a blackberry basil. Let's think. I'm going to flip through the book now and see.
Basil, I have to say basil blackberry sounds amazing to me.
It's nice because it's not like, it's not super herby. It's just got, it's primarily blackberry. And then you get like a little hint of that like peppery and icy sort of basil. But then on the topic of herbs, I really like using thyme, like in combination with lemon, that works really well. Rosemary could work. Just to add a little bit of a different flavor that kind of hits you second, but it's a nice, gives it a nice little something something.
Sarah Bond stays with us. She's the creator of the food blog Live, Eat, Learn and the author of the book For the Love of the Popsicle. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Daycare providers, summer camp staff and parents, what are your go-tos when creating sweet summer treats for the kids in your life? And athletes, do you rely on any naturally sweetened protein-laden popsicles after a workout? What do you use? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. Right now, we're continuing our talk with Sarah Bond, a recipe developer, food blogger, and the author of the book For the Love of the Popsicle. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What popsicles are in your freezer right now? What flavors do you like to make for yourself and your family? Have you ever tried an adult popsicle with alcohol as an ingredient? And do you make pupsicles for your canine buddies? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we heard from some of our coworkers here. Christy in membership makes Arnold Palmer popsicles. And I know that's one of the ones that's in the book For the Love of Popsicles. To make them, you put one lemon slice in your mold or cup. Then you fill it halfway with lemonade. Then you let that freeze for 5 minutes before adding tea to create a layered popsicle. That's a delicious drink. And that would be very refreshing on a summer day. Kay from the business sponsorship team at WPR makes pupsicles for her dog. She starts with small Tupperware containers, fills them halfway with water and broken dog treat pieces or crumbs from a treat or food bag. Doesn't sound too delicious to me, but I bet the dogs love it. The treats usually float, so freeze that. Then when solid, top with water and freeze again until solid. And popsicles, Sarah, that's something that you make as well. Oh, I think we don't have Sarah for the moment, but we also have a comment from Kathy. She's a WPR library volunteer and longtime listener. She said when her children were young, they added chocolate syrup to plain or vanilla yogurt and froze them in molds. She convinced them that those were fudgesicles, which I have to say growing up, that was one of my favorites. At some point, they did discover the commercial version. She said both boys are in their 40s now and parents themselves. So, Sarah, it sounds like a lot of folks are big fans of those frozen treats, popsicles.
Well, I think it also just goes back to everyone's childhood, so it's a bit of a nostalgic thing also. So I wanted to create something that the kids would like, the adults would like, looking back at the classics, but then also some adult ones with some alcohol and things. So there's a little bit for everybody.
Well, let's talk a little bit about those alcohol ones, because I know that alcohol itself doesn't freeze, which is why you can put, say, a bottle of vodka in the freezer and it'll be very cold, but it'll still be liquid. So is it all about the ratio of alcohol to other ingredients?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So you have to limit how much you use. I usually do about a 4-to-1 ratio, so 4 parts mixer to 1 part alcohol, and then generally that should freeze. It's going to be softer than your average popsicle, but the texture is actually really nice because it makes it kind of more biteable, and you don't have to wait for it to warm up at all. It's just instantly ready to eat.
Well, I think we've gotten people's mouths watering with all this talk of popsicles. Let's talk about how to make them. What kind of equipment do we need?
Well, you really just need a mold and popsicle sticks. but even that you don't need. So I have some idea starters in the book, but if you don't have a popsicle mold, you can do muffin tin. You can just do muffin tins and put the popsicle mixture in there. You can do shot glasses, works really well. Let's think. I've even done like a loaf pan. If you have a baking pan for bread, you can pour all the mixture in there and then put the sticks in and then just slice it into popsicles once it's frozen. So really, I think the only thing you need is some popsicle sticks.
And I really liked your suggestion that it can be tough to get the popsicle sticks to stand up, because if you put them in, if it's not a very thick mixture, if you put them in too soon, they might be all wonky. If you wait too long, you might not be able to get them in there because it's too frozen. And you suggested one way to do it is to put a layer of aluminum foil over the top and then just kind of poke them through. I thought that was a great idea.
Yeah, exactly. Because, having made over 100 batches of popsicles at this point, if I'd say for the first 20 or so, it was just the bane of my existence, having these popsicle sticks standing straight up, because, of course, it's not very photogenic having popsicle sticks everywhere. But so then I figured that out, and then it was a smooth sailing after that.
Let's go to the phones, and Anita is with us from Lindenhurst, Illinois. Hi, Anita.
Hi. I have a real simple one here. You have a watermelon. The last part of it gets a little too ripe and soft. You just scrape that out, put it in your blender, put it in your popsicle mold. That's it. It's really, really good.
Oh, and I have to say, I love watermelon. And that sounds easy and delicious to me. Sarah, yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I love watermelon in smoothies or in popsicles. And I've even seen, I haven't actually tried it, but I saw it on a video somewhere where you can even just cut the watermelon into slices and just put the popsicle stick in it and then freeze it like that.
Wow.
So I'm really curious if someone's tried that before. It looks super simple and super summery.
Well, they can let us know at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to the phones, and Mary in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Mary.
Hello. I make a frozen treat by using the metallic miniature cupcake holders, and what I put into them is simply either plain or vanilla Greek yogurt mixed with chocolate whey protein powder. So you're getting very low fat, but you're adding all that additional protein using the whey protein powder, and I happen to like the chocolate flavor. but I believe it comes in vanilla flavor and also strawberry, maybe even more. But when that's all mixed together and put into these little liners for muffin tins with a stick in the middle, it is just wonderful.
Wow. Well, that sounds great to me. And Greek yogurt, too, has a lot of protein. So I know, Sarah, that you talked about, you know, popsicles that would be really good for athletes, either before activity or to kind of recover after. That sounds like a great recipe from Mary.
Yeah, that one sounds really great. And the Greek yogurt is really nice because it has more protein, but it also has less water. And so the water is what makes the popsicles freeze really solid. So that's why if you use regular yogurt, then you get a more icy texture. So the Greek yogurt is perfect. And it sounds really tasty with that whey protein.
And you've shared a few recipes with us that we posted on WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's start with a classic flavor combo, cookies and cream. Talk us through that one.
Yeah, so that one is, it's kind of my take on like an Oreo cream popsicle with less fat and less sugar. So basically I do vanilla yogurt and then I do a little bit of cream cheese just to have that creamy flavor. And then a little bit of milk to get things moving and make it pourable. And then I do a sweetener, so I either use honey or sugar. And for this one, you could even substitute like a no-calorie sweetener, like stevia, if you like that.
Hmm.
And then some vanilla extract. And then I like to do some crushed Oreo cookies throughout it. And then as kind of a hidden surprise, I put a whole Oreo cookie into each popsicle well. So then you bite into it, and then you get an Oreo cookie. And it's really nice.
So you'd need a slightly bigger, maybe one of those, you know, kind of traditional, almost like the fudgesicle kind of shape ones to fit that whole Oreo. That would be a lovely surprise, I think, in the middle of it.
Yeah, definitely. Although I think you could do like in a muffin tin, you could put the Oreo at the bottom.
Yeah, yeah.
I guess it wouldn't be quite as hidden, but.
But it would still be something to look forward to. We're talking with Sarah Bond. She's a recipe developer and the creator of the food blog Live, Eat, Learn. We are talking with her about her book, For the Love of the Popsicle, Naturally Delicious Icy Sweet Summer Treats from A to Z. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And I want to ask you about something. I wanted to ask you if there were any misses instead of hits when you were doing all your research. And then I read your thank yous in your book, and you thanked, I believe, your partner for discouraging you from the cabbage popsicle.
Yeah, so this was it was a bold idea, this one. I had the idea. So red cabbage has that really bright purple color. And if you take cabbage juice or anything colored by cabbage, and you add an acid to it, so lemon juice, then it turns bright pink. And so it's kind of like a fun science experiment to see it change this color. So I had the idea for these like galaxy pops or something, where you would have a drink, like a pineapple juice, and then you'd stir a cabbage popsicle into it, and then it would be like a fun, delicious science experiment. But it was beautiful, and it was really nice to look at, but it tasted so bad.
Well, I have to say that sounds better than what I was imagining, which was like overboiled green cabbage. So at least you had the color going for you. But I think it's important for people to know that, you know, even when everything in a book looks beautiful and sounds delicious, there's a lot that goes on behind the scenes to get to that point.
Yeah, definitely.
So one of the things that you do is layer different flavors in a popsicle. What's the advantage of doing that?
You mean like having actual separate layers?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Honestly, it's just for the look of it. It's really pretty, and it's it kind of adds that nostalgia, especially like for the firecracker popsicles, which are the red, white, and blue, sort of like the rocket pops,
mm-hmm.
or Neapolitan. For those, it's always, if I can't decide which flavor I want, then I just make a Neapolitan with a vanilla, strawberry, chocolate, and So that's nice if you have people coming over or you have an event or something. It just looks nice. It's fun. Everyone likes it.
I was also thinking that the layering might be a nice technique if you have a couple flavors that you think will complement each other, but one might be quite a bit stronger than the other, and you don't want to completely overpower the one that might be a little more subtle.
Yeah, that's true. That's the case with the firecracker pops in my book. It's a strawberry and then a coconut and a blueberry layer. So the strawberry and the blueberry can be quite intense, but the coconut is sort of that break in the middle to just have something creamy and sort of mild before you get to the blueberry at the bottom. So, yeah, that makes sense.
Is there anything we should keep in mind for troubleshooting? We did talk about how to keep the sticks up. Is there anything that we need to know? One of the things is things expand when you freeze them. How much extra space should we leave?
I usually fill the mold about 3/4 full because it will expand. So if you fill it all the way to the top of your mold, then it's going to bubble up and probably leak out. And it just makes it a bit of a pain to unmold them. So yeah, just leave some space at the top to leave room for that expansion.
And what's the best way to get them out of the molds once they're frozen and ready to eat?
Yeah, so for this, I just really simply run the mold under warm water. So I've seen before where people will put them in a sink full of warm water or, wrap warm towels around them. But for me, I found it was easiest just to put the sink on warm and then just hold the popsicle mold under it and then move it constantly. So you have each mold sort of hit by the warm water a little bit, and then they should come out quite easily and quickly.
And of course, you said you've made, what, over 100 batches of popsicles, most of them successes, I'm guessing, and you feature many dozens of them in your book. Do you have a favorite? Is there one that you just keep going back to and always want to have in your freezer?
The one that's really the favorite in our whole family, they're called Darling Lemon Thymes. So it's buttermilk and lemon and thyme. And they're just really creamy and quite addictive. I'd say the fudge pops are the close runner-up for when you're craving something chocolatey because it's really rich and decadent, and it's just really coconut milk and cocoa powder.
Well, that sounds delicious. Sarah, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Sarah Bond is a recipe developer and the creator of the food blog Live, Eat, Learn. She's also the author of For the Love of the Popsicle, Naturally Delicious Icy Sweet Summer Treats from A to Z. She joined us from the Netherlands. You can find her recipes for cookies and cream, rhubarb strawberry, and s'mores popsicles on Food Friday page at WPR.org. That's WPR-food/Food Friday. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Governor Evers is proposing new limits on farm field runoff in order to protect groundwater. We'll talk about the geology of our water supply and what new research is telling us about pollution. First, we're going to take a look back at this week in Wisconsin politics with two big stories brewing at the Capitol. Last night, Republican state lawmakers filed a lawsuit against Democratic Attorney General Josh Call. They allege that he has not followed laws passed during the last legislative lame duck session, mainly that he has not sought legislative approval to settle lawsuits. The other story involves accessibility at the state capitol. Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson is paralyzed from the chest down and has asked to be able to participate in some committee meetings by phone. However, some lawmakers aren't on board. Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Patrick, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi there.
Let's start with the GOP lawsuit against Attorney General Josh Call. There have been a lot of lawsuits filed regarding the lame duck legislative session. What makes this lawsuit different from the others?
So this one is a little bit of a twist because the other lawsuits have been brought by Democrats or their allies trying to strike down the laws. This one is brought by Republican lawmakers asking that the court require the Attorney General to enforce provisions of it. The Republican lawmakers are contending that the Attorney General is not following parts of the law. They want to make sure that he does.
So previous lawsuits were Democrats saying that the lame duck legislation was not valid. This is actually a lawsuit from the Republicans saying, since it's been judged that it is, you need to follow this and you're not.
That's exactly right. And the Attorney General, for his part, says that he is following the law. The law is just more narrow than Republicans believe it is.
Are there specific Republican lawmakers who are bringing this lawsuit?
Yeah, it's brought by the leadership. It's Assembly Speaker Robin Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald, as well as the Senate President and maybe some others in leadership. It's in some ways an outgrowth of a lawsuit that unions brought challenging various aspects of the law. That case is still ongoing, but as it progresses, the state Supreme Court has said that virtually all aspects of the lame duck laws are in effect for now, and that's why the Republican leaders have come to the court to say, we have this new lawsuit and we want to make sure that the Attorney General is following the law, specifically regarding court settlements and how court cases can be ended.
Are there specific cases and settlements that they are pointing to say he should have come to us with this and he didn't?
In the filing that they made yesterday, they did not cite any specific lawsuits, but they made clear that they believe that there's a broad set of types of cases that when the Attorney General wants to settle them, he needs to go to a committee of lawmakers and get their permission to settle the case or to drop the case. And that money that is paid as part of those settlements must go into the state's general fund, sort of its main account to spend on various programs, rather than in places where the Attorney General has a say in how it's directed.
The timing of the lawsuit coincided with Wisconsin Supreme Court Justice Brian Hagedorn being sworn in just a couple hours before this was filed. He is a conservative. Is that likely to help their case?
Sure. The court, you know, has ruled so far in favor of Republicans. They had a 4-3 majority with Hagedorn now on the court. He replaces liberal justice Shirley Abrahamson. And so that's now a 5-2 majority that gives Republicans a little more breathing room on this and any other cases they might have.
Patrick, what will you be looking for as this story develops?
I think it's not a great idea to look at these cases in a vacuum. You kind of have to look at the broad sweep of them. The union lawsuit that this one is somewhat linked to is perhaps the more important case because it looks at this aspect on the Attorney General's powers, but also a broader set. You know, the lame duck laws chipped into the power of both the Attorney General and the governor in various ways. And that lawsuit really deals with many aspects of the lame duck laws. Will probably give us a better sense of how much is upheld and whether any of it is struck down.
We're talking with Patrick Marley. He's a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, talking about a couple developing stories at the state capitol. And Patrick, let's move on to another story. Democratic Representative Jimmy Anderson of Fitchburg has asked to be able to join committee meetings by phone. Representative Anderson is paralyzed from the chest down and says that there are reasons why it is sometimes not possible for him to join in person. What do the rules say currently for members of the assembly?
Assembly rules say that any member has to be physically present at a meeting to participate in it. So they have to be there in their chair to ask questions and otherwise engage in a meeting.
It's a little different in the Senate, though. Is that correct?
That's right. So each house gets to set its own rules. So you do have the Senate where members can call in. So it's not uncommon to go to a committee meeting and find some of the senators in their chair and some of the senators calling in through a speakerphone. And then to further complicate things, they have joint committees, which consist of both members of the Senate and the Assembly. And so for those committees, at least for some of those joint committees, they allow members, including Assembly members, to phone in. So it sort of depends which type of committee we're talking about. But the primary standing committees for the Assembly, they can't call into. Jimmy Anderson says that to accommodate his disability, he needs to be able to call into some of them.
We had Representative Anderson on Central Time last week, and we asked him a question about accessibility. It was on the eve of the 29th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Here's what he had to say.
Yeah, I mean, it's pivotal. It's all about making sure that people get the proper accommodations that they request, and all they're asking for is simple dignity. I mean, they just want to be included in the process, and the ADA has been pivotal to making sure that people in the workplace have been able to get that dignity.
That was Representative Jimmy Anderson. He was on Central Time last week talking about the ADA, not this case specifically because this has come up since then, but what he said falls in line with what he's requesting from the legislative leaders. What has their reaction been to his request, Patrick?
They've been not interested so far in allowing him to call into meetings. The Assembly Speaker, Robin Voss, sent him a letter yesterday saying that he may make another accommodation for him where meetings would be videotaped. The details on that are not clear, if it would be a live stream or if it would be something that Jimmy Anderson would have to watch afterward. And most of the letter from Voss was very critical of Jimmy Anderson, saying that he was politically grandstanding, that he should have raised his concerns directly with Voss or with HR officials rather than talking to the press about it. Jimmy Anderson says months ago he went to Democratic leaders and raised these concerns, and they then presented them to Voss. So he says he did try to go through the process to try to get this dealt with in a less public way.
And it's hard to predict, but is this likely to end up in the courts?
So Jimmy Anderson says that he his push for the moment is to try to change the assembly rules to essentially incorporate the Americans with Disability Act so that he and anybody else who had a disability or health issue would be able to be accommodated. But he told me yesterday that increasingly he thinks this is going to become a lawsuit, that Voss's unwillingness to work with him means that he will have to sue. And whether he does, you know, then it would be up to a court to decide whether Jimmy Anderson gets to phone into these meetings.
It sounds like this has primarily been between Speaker Voss and Representative Anderson right now. Have any other legislators on either side of the aisle spoken out or made comment on this?
The Assembly Democrats have largely been, you know, on Jimmy Anderson's side, putting things on Twitter and Facebook, saying that they're on his side and they want the rules changed. Assembly Republicans have mostly stayed quiet. I spoke with Representative Joan Balwig the other day because she is chairwoman of a joint committee that does allow members to call in. And so they had two assembly members call in just the other day. One was a Democrat, one was a Republican. She said she doesn't like that rule, but because it's a joint committee, she had to negotiate with the Senate on it. And her preference is to require assembly members to be present at committee meetings. She did, however, say that perhaps this was an issue that should be negotiated some for circumstances like Jamie Anderson's, where he has a disability.
And what do you think the next steps in this will be?
The assembly is not in session until the fall. So if they don't resolve things among themselves before then, I'm sure they will have a big fight on the floor about it, and whether, you know, the Democrats will likely try to force a vote to change the rules. And, you know, it appears that a lawsuit's possible, certainly, so we'll just have to stay tuned. Certainly the issue is not going away one way or the other. You know, there's either going to be something negotiated or there's going to be a lawsuit, it would appear to me.
Well, Patrick, thanks so much for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thanks a lot.
Patrick Marley is a state government and politics reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He joined us today to talk about the GOP challenging Attorney General Josh Call over lame duck laws and a fight over accessibility in the assembly. Coming up, Governor Evers is proposing stronger limits on farm runoff as new research shows southwestern Wisconsin is still dealing with contaminated private wells. We'll find out more about the geology of groundwater and pollution. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, an Oneida County official allegedly used public equipment and prison labor for a project on his private land. We'll find out more about what a recent investigation found during our state news roundup. Now, Governor Tony Evers announced yesterday that his administration will be writing up new proposals. They aim to put stronger limits on the runoff from farm fields in order to protect groundwater. Evers has declared 2019 as the year of clean drinking water. Also yesterday, the state's Geological Survey released new results showing that contamination is still a problem for some people using private wells in southwestern Wisconsin's Grant, Iowa, and Lafayette counties. That's part of an ongoing study of the area's water quality. Ken Bradbury is the director of the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. He joins us in the studio. Ken, thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Water quality is getting a lot of political and public attention recently. Yesterday, as we said, Governor Evers said he'll be proposing new limits on farm runoff, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is head of a water quality task force. Why do you think this is such a front and center issue for so many people right now?
Well, water is about the most valuable thing we have in Wisconsin. It's what we call the buried treasure, and it's something that everybody uses and everybody needs, and it's something that's pretty hard to be against. So water quality is a good play to unite people, and we do have problems, particularly with groundwater quality, and many, many people across the state are using groundwater for drinking. So it's a cause that unites people.
Let's talk a little bit about definitions. What do we mean specifically when we say groundwater?
Groundwater is water that's stored and transported in rocks and soil and cracks and fractures and pores in the rocks below our feet. And most people in Wisconsin, unless you live in Milwaukee or Green Bay or along Lake Michigan, are using groundwater for just about everything.
So this is not water that we're seeing on a daily basis. This is water underneath.
It's water underground, but we do see some of it because it's coming out and it's providing base flow to our lakes and streams and springs. So that you do when you see a stream like Black Earth Creek flowing in the summer, that's because of groundwater flowing into it. But you're right, most of the groundwater is invisible to us.
Yesterday, as we said, the Wisconsin Geological Survey put out a new finding as part of an ongoing study in southwest Wisconsin. And out of the 35 private wells that you tested, 32 contained fecal contamination. That, to me, as a layperson, sounds pretty alarming. What does that result mean to you?
Well, I wanted to give you some context for that, because even on the earlier reports on public radio, had that a little bit confusing. The 30 wells that were sampled were wells that we already knew to be contaminated. We had done a sampling of over 800 wells prior. To look at whether they had any bacteria at all or high nitrate. We then picked these 32 wells for to resample to actually determine the source of the bacteria.
Got it. So you already knew that those wells had problems. We already knew
they would be contaminated. So the whole point of this was source tracking to see whether that contamination was from people or from animals, from cows or pigs or people.
And what did you find?
Well, interestingly enough, the majority were from people, from human pathogens. Maybe a little surprising, but not completely surprising because this is the first of three rounds of sampling. This was early in the year before there's been a lot of fertilizer spread and a lot of manure put on fields. So it may have been dominated by a human septic waste. A similar study in Kewaunee County found the same thing, that earlier in the year samples were more human and later in the year were more agriculture. So we'll have to see what we get from future samplings there.
And I remember reading that it can depend on the time of year. What is it about those different seasons that could make one type of contamination more likely than the other?
Well, of course, we get groundwater recharge or groundwater entering the system at different times of the year. So that's a change that happens seasonally. But then you have to think how farmers are disposing of manure and when they fertilize their fields. Certain period when they're doing that, they don't do it much in the winter. But our human septic tanks are going all the time, of course. So there's kind of a background, we think, of human waste, and then the ag waste may be more episodic after different farming practices are happening seasonally.
We're talking with Ken Bradbury right now. He's the director of the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. And we're talking about the geology of Wisconsin's groundwater after new research showed that some residents of southwestern Wisconsin are still dealing with contaminated wells. And let's talk about that geology of Wisconsin and where our water comes from. How does the makeup of our bedrock and water tables vary from region to region in Wisconsin?
Well, as a geologist, Wisconsin is a pretty fascinating place because we have all kinds of rock here. We have some of the oldest rock in the world and some of the youngest glacial deposits, so it's really interesting. But to get to your question, the study we're doing now is in southwest Wisconsin, Iowa, Grant, and Lafayette counties. The geology there is mostly rock called dolomite, or some people would call it limestone, and there's some sandstone in there, but it's a package of a number of different rock formations, many of which are dolomite or limestone. And these rocks are fractured. They have some cavities or even caves in them, And in particularly in the upland ridges, there's very little soil. So they're quite vulnerable to anything moving downward from the surface. Doesn't get much filtration from the soil in certain places. Other parts of Wisconsin have much, like here in Dane County, there's actually, for most of the county, thicker soil. Go to central Wisconsin, we have sandy soil, which is still a vulnerable place, but a different kind of geology.
Let's talk about the agricultural runoff, because I think it could seem like, well, if you put it on in the right, the right proportions at the right time of year, this shouldn't be happening. But is there any way to completely, first of all, avoid agricultural runoff?
Well, we're talking about two things here. Runoff is water that runs over the surface and gets into streams and lakes. And then what we've been talking about up to now is water that seeps into the ground and becomes groundwater. So they're two different pathways. Both of those can be improved by best management practices like, certain kinds of tillage and planting cover crops and things like that, not over-applying. But, when we add things to the landscape, we're always going to get some residual. That's something we've found out again and again when we study these things, that there's really not a no-impact scenario. But to controlling this, the first thing we have to do is best management and making sure farm practices are as good as they could be. And, many Wisconsin farmers are working hard to do that. We know that.
What about the issue of flooding? It certainly seems that in recent years, we have seen more and more consistent flooding in Wisconsin. Is that also an issue when the amounts of water are so increased and in such a short amount of time? Does that affect our groundwater?
Well, absolutely. It can affect it in a couple of ways. First of all, when we have a catastrophic flood, and it overtops people's wells sometimes. So if the floodwater can go over the top of the well, then that contaminated floodwater, and it's often almost always contaminated, can drain down into the well. And that is a very serious situation, and those wells shouldn't be used until they've been disinfected. Beyond that, other floods, with climate change, we're getting a lot more intense rainfalls, as we have seen this spring and summer. And that can cause more runoff. It can also drive groundwater farther into the, recharge down faster. On the other hand, it's replenishing groundwater levels. So, it's a good thing in some ways, but a bad thing in other ways.
What should people who rely on well water, private wells, know about making sure that their groundwater is healthy and their drinking water is safe?
Well, one thing that I like to make sure the private well owners understand is that they are in charge of their own water. And, there's no public water utility that's going to come and sample it for them or anything like that. Sometimes a study like we've been doing, they will get sampled for free. But other than that, and the majority of people we recommend sample their water at least once a year for nitrate and bacteria in particular. So that they know what their own water quality is like, because otherwise no one else is paying attention. And then they need to maintain their well. It's surprising to me that, a private well is perhaps the most important appliance or a piece of equipment in your whole property. And yet it's the thing people know least about. And so you need to understand where your well is, how it looks, how it's capped, that you don't drive your car into it or pile garbage on top of it and that sort of thing. So a little knowledge and education goes a long way.
And before we let you go, Ken, you've been looking at the southwestern part of Wisconsin. Are you going to continue focusing your research there, or will you be looking at other areas of the state as well?
Well, right now we have a major project in Southwest, but we have our survey has – we have geological and groundwater projects across the state. We've been working in eastern Wisconsin, the Door County and so forth, and in the Central Sands as well. So we have quite a few different projects going on. Groundwater is important everywhere.
So you'll be continuing this type of investigations around the state?
You bet, yeah.
Well, we will certainly look forward to updates because, as you said, water is something we all share and we're all invested in. Ken, thanks so much for joining us today.
Absolutely.
Ken Bradbury is the director of the Wisconsin Geological and Natural History Survey. He was with us to talk about the geology of Wisconsin's groundwater after new research showed that some residents of southwestern Wisconsin are still dealing with contaminated wells. And yesterday, Governor Evers proposed stricter limits on runoff coming from farm fields. You can let us know what you want to see from the government on the issue of water quality. Is this a concern in your area? Do you trust your drinking water? If you have a private well, do you know how to take care of it? What do you see as the causes and possible solutions for water quality problems? You can let us know by sending us an email. That email address is ideas@wbr.org. It's a bittersweet day for us on Central Time today. It's longtime producer Brianne Shasso's last day with us here on the Ideas Network. As a network producer, Brianne works on every show on the Ideas Network. So you have heard conversations she has put together, not just on Central Time, but also on The Morning Show and The Larry Mueller Show. Brianne is incredibly well-rounded. Not only can she put together hard-hitting interviews about policy, the economy, and the environment, she also excels at fun chats, like the one she produced about popsicles today. A lot goes into producing a daily talk show, and Brianne's ability to juggle multiple programs and variable hours, all the while being a mentor and friend to her colleagues, has been valuable in ways we can't even begin to describe. Brianne is a gifted journalist, and we are sad to see her go back to her native state of Minnesota, but we are excited for her next adventure. We wish Brianne all the best and can't wait to see what she does next. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR, and then the Department of Natural Resources is bringing back a popular exhibit at the State Fair this year. We'll find out more during our Wisconsin News Roundup. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.